Tate Chronicles now transmitting.
Welcome to the Tate Chronicles on Healthcare Now Radio. And now, here's your host, Jim Tate.
Good day, citizens of the free world, from border to border, coast to coast, and to all the ships at sea, I bring you a warm welcome. This is your correspondent, Jim Tate, and thank you for tuning in today to the Tate Chronicles. Join me as we cut through the fog that exists at the leading edge of healthcare delivery and technology. I'm really pleased my guest today is Tony Shuith. Tony's the founder, CEO, and managing partner of Point of Care Partners. He's been in the healthcare field for over 25 years. And Point of Care Partners, or better known as POCP, is a leading management consulting firm working with healthcare organizations in evaluation, development, and implementation of health information management strategies. So first, Tony, welcome to the Tate Chronicles.
Thanks, Jim. I'm delighted to be here.
Before we get into some of the details of standards and things like that, tell me a little bit about Point of Care Partners. Who are your clients and what are the services you provide?
Sure. Point of Care Partners is a management consulting company that provides market intelligence, business and product strategy, program, project, and product management to a wide array of different healthcare IT companies, from payers to providers to even life sciences or pharmaceutical companies and the technology companies that support each of those. What really makes us different, Jim, is that we focus on certain subject matters and then we go deep in those areas of subject matter expertise. And then we work with all stakeholders involved in those. So as opposed to some consultants that just work with payers or some consultants that just work with providers, you know, we work across the spectrum, focusing on certain subject matters. And that allows us to really help our clients with their business strategy because it helps them to sort of, we can bring the perspective of, you know, maybe another organization that's also a stakeholder in that topic. We can bring their perspective to that, you know, encounter and help, you know, our clients really sort of understand how this subject matter area is evolving, who's involved, what their motivations are, you know, what they might oppose, what they might support. It's really, you know, a really nice model. And we've grown the business, at least revenue, an average of 20% a year since we started about 18 years ago.
You know, one of the things that kind of fascinates me as you talk, Tony, is the fact that you're viewing things through a number of different lenses, depending on the stakeholder's position. And I know one of the things that you're involved with is the setting of standards development. Now, you know, we talk about standards in healthcare, and that could be standards for discrete codified data for medications or diagnoses. But there's also standards around the interoperability files, CCDAs, edge protocols for secure communication, things like that. Sometimes it takes a long, long time to develop standards. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on, you know, how this whole process of speeding up of standards development can be done with this multi-stakeholder approach.
Well, you are so right, Jim. It does take a long time. It really does. I've been involved in standards development for more than 30 years, I would say. And in the early days of all of this, you know, we'd get together and we'd, you know, identify a problem and we'd work together. And, you know, what we found was that a lot of very committed, energetic, passionate people that wanted to sort of, you know, advance healthcare, advanced, you know, technology that supports healthcare, work together to solve problems. But it can take a while. And part of the reason for that, Jim, is that there is a process that standard development organizations need to follow so that they get consensus on what it is that they publish. And consensus doesn't mean that everybody necessarily agrees, okay? But consensus does mean that everybody gets to have their say and the majority sort of supports, you know, the standard that's evolved. And so what ends up happening is it's a process that, you know, that takes a period of time, because you got to give everybody a chance to have their say. If somebody's opposed to something that's in a standard, you have to be able to hear them out and weigh their arguments, and then as a broader group sort of decide how you want to move forward. So there's a process that we've been following for years. There's a accrediting agency called the American National Standards Institute, ANSI, and HL7, NCPDP, X12, they're all part of ANSI, and they follow that process. But one of the things that we discovered early on in standards development is that there are ways to sort of accelerate the process. And one of the ways that we can accelerate the process is, instead of just having volunteers take a whiteboard, you know, and start creating something from scratch, if we have somebody that's committed and can sort of put something on paper that then people can react to, everyone still has a chance for their say, but you put something on paper that people can react to, you're going to move things along a little bit faster. So that was how we did it a decade ago. What's emerged more recently have been what HL7 calls accelerators. Now, I used that word before, but now I'm going to put it in a capital letter instead of a lowercase. And interesting enough, the first accelerator that started up before there were accelerators was a project called the Argonaut Project. And Argonaut was all about using HL7 FHIR standards, FHIR standards, to support interoperability between provider organizations. And it's noteworthy not only because it's the first one, but because the gentleman that ran it, that was the lead of it, his name is Mickey Tripathi, and Mickey is now the national coordinator for health IT under President Biden. So you know, we think that these accelerators are here to stay. There's another one that I'm more familiar with than Argonaut that's emerged, and it's called DaVinci. So the DaVinci project, named after the artist and inventor, for no other reason, I think, than people thought that he was an interesting man in history. But this DaVinci project began to form, looking at what the Argonaut project had done, and what they decided that they would do is something similar. And that was started by a group of payers and providers. So the idea behind DaVinci was to create standards that supported value-based care. Jim, you know, and I think there's consensus in our country right now, that we can't afford to continue a healthcare system where we're paying fee-for-service. So we have to evolve to one that's value-based. And the payers got together and said, in order for us to accomplish that objective, we're going to need standards that support value-based care. And so they paired, you know, they combined and worked with provider organizations, and they identified use cases, and these provider organizations and payers and some technology companies as well have all come together to sort of solve some of our problems and support value-based care. And they're not just any payers. The first one to step up were the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. The second was United. And United actually has two seats at the table, United and Optum. CMS fee-for-service was also there in the very beginning. And several other big payers and provider organizations have since joined. They're up to 50 different members right now. And so this model of all of these stakeholders, and it includes the federal government. I mentioned CMS. ONC is also not necessarily a participant, but they keep a close eye on these standards. And so when the standards sort of pass, when an implementation guide passes through that ANSI accredited process that I mentioned earlier, and when it gets to, you know, when it's voted on and then it's published, ONC is putting it into regulations as soon as they can. So it has become a powerful force in healthcare right now. And if you're not paying attention to what these accelerators are doing, you know, I advise that you do that, because that's, you know, where change is really happening in healthcare IT right now.
Tony, in the trajectory of standards development, kind of what you just touched on, right there, where they're published, adopted by ONC, then they have to be implemented and they have to be used. And so an example I'll give, you know, this probably all started a lot of ways back, I guess maybe in 2004, 2005 was CCHIT, where we started having the first certifications of electronic health records.
Right.
And the requirement for various standards. And we've got requirements now that for interoperability files, like CCDAs, and soon it's going to be standards mandate for fire that we'll get into in a few minutes. The presence of those alone won't do much unless it's actually being used to move healthcare data to the point of care. And so that seems like that's being done by reimbursement type things, like whether it was meaningful use or the new promoted interoperability, macro MIPS program, those kind of things. So could you speak to that a little bit? Once we have the standards, how do we get it implemented and used?
You're absolutely right. Some standards that we've developed over the years have just sort of sat on the shelf and never been used. You know, it's a sad situation that we don't want to see repeated. And you're absolutely right. You know, Jim, I've been in this business for a long time, so I like to look at it from a historical perspective. And you're absolutely right. Meaningful use, that's really what it was all about, was we've created these standards. Let's, you know, use this money that was set aside in the Recovery Act. Let's use this money to encourage providers, hospitals, and physicians to not only adopt technology, but to use it. And if they use it meaningfully, then we'll, you know, we'll compensate them for that. And so I would say that meaningful use was the first substantial major program that came out. But interesting enough, I was involved in a few others around electronic prescribing, you know, where doctors were, they were encouraged to prescribe electronically and paid a little extra in their Medicare payments for a period of time. And then after that, they were penalized for not using it. And the interesting juxtaposition between the two of those is the program where they were paid to prescribe electronically, it wasn't a lot of money. Meaningful use was a substantial amount of money. We both know that. But the e-prescribing piece wasn't a lot. And so what we found there is that if you incent doctors or incent healthcare providers or incent people in healthcare to use something, and then, yes, you penalize them if they choose not to, you know, what you're going to get is more and more utilization. Now, what's happened with DaVinci is that DaVinci has sort of built in utilization into their whole overall program. So each payer that is a part of DaVinci got to pick a provider that they got to bring along to also become a member of the organization. So some providers paid for their own way, but in other cases, a payer would bring one along. And the criteria for bringing them along is that they wanted to be a partner in testing these transactions. And so it's been really successful, I think. And I do believe that DaVinci and other, you know, these other sort of accelerators have understood from the get-go that they're going to have to bring providers along and people are going to have to use them for there to be meaningful impact on you know, on healthcare IT.
One of the biggest standards touched on a little earlier is the FHIR standard, F-H-I-R. And maybe about 5 years ago, we started hearing the whispers and now it's being shouted at the top of everybody's lungs. And so in terms of interoperability, it seems that the FHIR standard is more revolutionary than just an evolutionary step in the access to health records from one system to another. You'd give some examples, maybe a little bit about what FHIR is, but what FHIR does and why it's important, the FHIR standard.
Sure. I want to start out, though, by making a key point. So within my own consulting company, we have 20 or so consultants and you know, full-time employees and another 100 subcontractors, and we often get together and we debate and we discuss things. And I have to tell you, Jim, that there's been some skepticism within my organization about FHIR. And it mostly comes from people that have been around health IT as long as you and I both have. And a lot of times when something is hyped at the level that you're talking about, that leads to sort of disappointment down the road. But those same people that have been skeptical about FHIR all along are coming around. You know, they're now seeing the light. They're now seeing, you know, what you just described, which is that it's game changing. Now, is it evolutionary versus revolutionary? You know, it's a little of both, right? Because what it is it's using internet technology to exchange healthcare information, but, you know, looking at its core at HL7 version 2, CCDA version 3, and, you know, that's what the U.S. healthcare system is sort of built on, you know, from a technology standpoint. And so it's taking, you know, applying internet technology to that data and moving it from point A to point B in a really sort of targeted and strategic way. So instead of just shifting, you know, large amounts of data, which is what the CCDA did, you know, it's very targeted. It allows you to be very targeted. Each sort of data packet of information is tagged. And so it allows you to really, you know, hone in on what information that you want to get from point A to point B, which, oh, by the way, was in the spirit of HIPAA. You know, sure. We want to make sure that the provider has the information that he or she needs at the point of care, at the time, for the patient, under that condition, in that context, you know, and that's what FHIR really does. And that's why it's so exciting. And I'll use the term game changing. I think it is game changing. I believe it's game changing. And I do believe there is a fair amount of hype, but it's not the kind of hype that is gonna dissipate. We're changing healthcare. We're changing it for the good. And you know, it's an exciting time to be in healthcare IT.
Well, and let me ask you a scenario. See if this is realistic. If I was a pediatrician at a practice and taking care of children that have moved from another area, would I be able to reach out and only get their immunization information, nothing else?
Would you be able to reach out?
Mm-hmm.
You would. But, you know, are we at the point where we're ready to do that tomorrow? Tomorrow, it depends on how you really define tomorrow. Like
sure,
tomorrow,
sure.
The day after today, no. But in the very near future, we'll be at that point. Let me tell you another story. I before this radio broadcast started, I told you that I live in North Florida. Before that, I lived in South Florida. So I was a Cleveland Clinic Florida patient. And in 2018, I moved to North Florida. And the very first thing that I did was I reached out to Mayo Clinic and I said, I want to become a patient of yours. But before I left South Florida, I went to Cleveland Clinic and I said, you know, I want to take my records with me. Of course, I had the right to do that, right? And they said, you don't need to do that. And I said, what do you mean? They said, all you have to do is sign a form when you get to Mayo, and they can just, you know, pull the information directly in from us here at Cleveland Clinic to Mayo. Now, there are different systems, right? And even at the time, today, Mayo is an Epic shop, and Cleveland Clinic is, of course, an Epic shop, a longtime Epic shop. But at that time, Mayo hadn't converted Jacksonville to Epic. So it was still the old sort of Mayo healthcare system. And I just signed a form, and wouldn't you know, as I'm sitting there, the doctor who's sort of onboarding me and welcoming me into the practice, you know, sees my health information. Guess what? It saved us a lot of time, or at least we were able to focus on, you know, more meaningful things than when I had my tonsils out and when I had my, you know, mm-hmm. appendectomy and things like that.
I think that's what they call interoperability, isn't it, Tony?
It sure is. It sure is.
Let me ask you about another standard that may not be clinical data, but almost everybody wishes we had. That's a national patient identifier. Now, for years, I think there was federal legislation that prevented this.
Yes, it was.
What's the status of that now? Because it sure would be nice to know if patient A is patient A.
You're absolutely right. So first of all, I have to say, Jim, that we're not going to have true interoperability in the United States until we have a national patient identifier. I believe that. My organization believes that. We really do. That is something that we feel strongly about. You know, we've had workarounds and different systems use different kinds of, you know, variations of some kind of identifiers. We're, you know, not allowed to use the Social Security number. Medicare, though, has come along, and there's a Medicare patient identifier, an MPI. But the status, you asked what the status is, and so the status is that we're in the process of studying it. They, ONC, announced that they were doing a study on this in, I believe it was 2019. It was part of an appropriations bill where they set aside money to study this. They haven't come out with the final report. We expect that to be sometime this year, that we'll see a final report where they're evaluating different options. Social Security is one option, but a lot of people are very concerned about using Social Security number to be our patient identifier. Again, the Medicare patient identifier is an option, but of course, not everybody's in Medicare. You have to be over a certain age. There are some other options that some other organizations have done that have been more sort of, you know, more commercially designed. Mm-hmm. So I would say we are probably, you know, we're at least in 20. The only thing I can predict is in 2021, we'll have a sort of an analysis and an option that will be presented on the table. There's still a lot of political concern about, you know, using and having a national patient identifier. And so there's going to be a lot of debate about it. It just because the report comes out doesn't mean that that's going to be the answer to all of our, you know, all of our problems. But again, if we want to truly get to interoperability, true interoperability, we're going to have to be able to do that.
I was at your company's website, so I guess that's pocp.com, reading some of the blogs yesterday, Tony. You know, one of the things that struck me, kind of underlined it for me again and again, is that we're not looking at just raw data. There are other things that, different ways to look at data. And I read one of the blog posts, someone in your company wrote it, on the social determinants of health.
Yes.
And so that's a big thing these days, to kind of tease out the nuances that are in that data rather than just, you know. And so, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, it was all about just the analysis of data without maybe looking underneath or behind the data. So there seems to be a direction there that's going on. And, you know, whether it's in clinical trials and who the clinical trials are made up of, or that the actual databases underneath the standards and the clinical decision support rules, where that's coming from and what that data reflects as far as the population demographic.
Well, you know, social determinants of health have been proven through different, you know, peer-reviewed studies to be profoundly impactful to our health. And some of the last coordinators for health IT have made a big point of let's talk about health, not health care, which is sort of the delivery of care. Health is the health of the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely, it's critically important. And we are right now trying to get our arms around it. You know, things like, you know, gender preferences, race, you know, locations, ability to commute, you know, to get services.
Sure.
All of those things sort of fall under the social determinants of health. What we've been testing to date have been more where, you know, where patients respond to sort of surveys with certain information. And that information the questions have been sort of determined and designed by, you know, by our best and brightest scientists. So the information, you know, we have a standard set of information that we're asking about. We have a standard, you know, we're trying to sort of capture the response in a standardized way. We have the ability to get that into an EHR, maybe not nationwide, but we've been able to do that in certain pockets. It's been exceptionally helpful to the providers who have that information. You know, there are some organizations that are more advanced around using social determinants of health. One that I recall, you know, seeing a presentation about is Rush in Chicago, you know, how they were able to, you know, really help some of their patients do things like sort of pre-COVID, do things like get to, you know, their appointments and making sure that they stay on their, you know, their different medications and things like that. So we're making progress, but I would say we're still in a little bit of the early days.
I think so too. You know, I was just running across what they call pharmacy deserts, zip codes that don't have any pharmacies in them.
Yeah.
So that's certainly part of it. Tony, I can't believe it, but we're almost totally out of time. We could go easily for another hour, but I want to thank you for your time today. And to our audience, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Tate Chronicles. I offer, of course, a special salute to my guest today, Tony Schuith. Tony, thanks for coming aboard today.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. Appreciate the time.
You can find more information on this show's program page at healthcarenowradio.com. Until we meet again, here's wishing you smooth sailing and safe harbors.
Tate Chronicles transmission ending now.